near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from the journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman from Samaria came up to draw the water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, How is it that you, a Jew, asked for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Jesus answered, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." And the woman said to him, "Sir, I have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You're right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming where neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You will worship what you do not know. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for the salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and is now here, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that the Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he."
Well, good morning. It's good to see you, and I can actually see you. So we're trying this 1 week, see how it goes, right? We had a little bit of complaint that it was too dark in here, and our problem is that we either have this or the ambiance of low light, and because those are our options as we turn on lights in here. We either have the tube lights above you, which half of them are out, or these, and that's our option. So we're trying this, but the one thing I do know is that other weeks when you fall asleep, I can't tell. This morning, I can eyeball you, all right? And so it's just the way it works. Thank you, Scott. So, but it's good to see you this morning. We're glad you're here hanging out. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Hope you overate, but not too much maybe. But more than that, I hope you found a time to do what is at the heart of worship, which is to give thanks, to acknowledge our Creator for the gifts that he has done. Thanksgiving is a good day. It is good for us to set aside a day to say, listen, we have been given so much. Let's rejoice in this and to give thanks, but to know that we have someone to thank. And then hopefully that will springboard us into more of a lifestyle of that. That is worship. That is what it means to honor and give glory to our God. But as we're looking at this story, this is an amazing story of the woman at the well. And as I've just been kind of wading through this week, I'm just reminded of how messy life really is. One of the problems as we try to do religion, as we try to come together as the people of God and let the gospel work in our lives, is it's very easy to try to fit everything in a nice, neat, tidy little box that says, all right, this is the way we're supposed to live, this is how we're supposed to act, this is what we're supposed to do. And as we try to pursue the things of God, all of a sudden that box gets very small, and the messiness of life, it's hard to contain that in there. And then you start living life around people, and you realize our lives are really messy. There's a lot of brokenness in the world, and a lot of people who have these deep struggles that go back to all kinds of things. These people who have rough upbringings, and these people who ended up with all kinds of challenges in their lives. These people who've made catastrophic mistakes in their lives. These people who struggle with different types of identity and are outcasts and are broken. And the question is, how can our religion ever speak into that? And more importantly, if we believe in Jesus, what does it look like for Jesus to deal with that? And so here's this woman who fits in this box. She kind of in our world becomes, you know, the person who been affected by the sex slave trade. And the question we have to answer is somebody who comes from that kind of lifestyle, whose life has just been, she's been used as a thing. Does the gospel have any power in that person's life? Or people who struggle with things like gender identity or sexual identity, how does the gospel, like, do we have anything to offer those people? If they don't fit in our nice, neat little religious box that looks like, you know, the proper, you know, person who has their life kind of together and, you know, lives in a house, you know, that's a two-story house and seems to put forward a presentation of their lives that we have it all together, if they're just a hot mess, does the gospel that we believe in, the Jesus that we hold on to, offer anything to those people? And if it doesn't, then there's something wrong, because what happens as you read the New Testament is that Jesus shows up on the scene, and one of the amazing things that happens as you study the life of Jesus is you see him intentionally, like intentionally engaging people that religion just will keep at an arm's length. And he intentionally steps into lives of people who are a hot mess. And we live in a messy world, and does the gospel have anything to offer those people? The gospel that we believe, the gospel that we preach, the gospel that we hold to. If you're a follower of Jesus, that's what we want to look at. But if you're here this morning and you feel like your life is a hot mess, we have a message for you today. We just want to let you know that there is a beautiful picture of Jesus here as he engages a woman whose life is just devastated. It's just broken. She is struggling. She is hurting. She is an outcast. She has really, the text kind of leads us to believe, just been used. And here Jesus intentionally engages her, intentionally encounters her. And we need to see this Jesus. We need to see this Jesus, first of all, because this morning we need to understand that the gospel that Jesus offers is often something way different from the idea that religion embeds in us. And second of all, we need to see this story. We need to encounter this woman. We need to see how Jesus interacts with her, because if we are going to be Jesus' people, then we need to like be propelled by what the story shows us about our King, our Savior, our Redeemer. And in the end, the truth of the matter is every single one of us needs to identify ourselves with this woman, see in her story that it really does fit my story, even if I grew up from the religious background and I was the good kid. And so what happens here is that Jesus is on his way from the southern part of Israel to the northern part, and he is going to walk through and move from Judea to Samaria, but he makes a bypass from the normal route and encounters this woman. One of the cool things, we're studying John. If you've been hanging out with us, you know this, but we've been studying this beautiful story of the life of Jesus called the Gospel of John, written by one of his best friends. And John is trying to make sure that people see Jesus in the richness of his identity, the depth of his being, that like we really see Jesus in clarity. And one of the ways that John does this is John recalls encounters that Jesus had with individuals and gives us these rich and deep conversations that Jesus has with people like Nicodemus. We saw a couple of weeks ago, this highly religious Jewish leader who, he was the guy who had it all together. He was the guy who fit in the religious box very well. And Jesus disrupted that box significantly by telling him he had to be born again, and confusing him and kind of leaving him kind of dangling out there to seek after what Jesus was saying he needed to search after. Well, now we see Jesus having this conversation with this woman at this well in Samaria, and we'll see this several other times where Jesus stops and has significant dialogue, significant encounters with people, and we see the beauty of Christ. We see his compassion. We see his love. We see the depth of who he is when he stops. And this story is one of the most amazing, beautiful, rich stories we'll ever find. Now, the challenge this morning for me is the fact that the truth is, I ought to do about 6 sermons out of this story. There are so many rich and deep themes that show up in the story, and I would love to sit here and touch them all. And as we kind of mapped out, what does it look like to preach the Gospel of John? One of the things that I've constantly wrestled with is this going to be like something that takes us about a year, or are we going to be like here for 2 or 3 years? and kind of saying, how are we going to do this? And really, we decided we're going to kind of stay like one story at a time and not get lost in any story for too long. But this story has so many themes and ideas, even down to where this well is and what it means, and the fact that it's tied to this patriarch named Jacob and that he built the well. And there's meaning there. But what we have here is this, like what I want us to get really connected to is this woman and how Jesus interacts with her and what he offers her. Because I think that offer is true. I think that we can go to any person, no matter where they're at in their life, and say, listen, Jesus has something that is rich and beautiful, and we're not trying to put you in a religious box. We're not trying to make you into something that you're not. What we want to do for you is offer you a Savior who will reach your deepest needs and will satisfy you on a level that what you are doing will not. And we all need to hear that, right? And so the text tells us that first of all, it tells us that Jesus was in Judea. This is connected to the previous chapter where it tells us that Jesus and his disciples have been doing some baptisms. Now there's clarity. It wasn't Jesus. It was his disciples who were baptizing. But the Pharisees heard about it. The religious leaders in Jerusalem, the main religious city, the capital, it's where the temple is. They've heard that Jesus is baptizing more than this guy named John the Baptist. And so now the pressure on Jesus is turning up a little bit. And he has decided that he's going to leave the region of Judea in Palestine. If you can picture in your brain where Israel is today, at the very southern part of that where Jerusalem is, this would be the region called Judea. Galilee is all the way to the north. It's where Jesus grew up. It's the hometown of most of the hometown region of most of his disciples. And what it tells us that it was that he was going to leave Judea because of this, and he is going to go to Galilee. As you read the other Gospels, the bulk of his ministry takes place after this trip. Jesus is going to go to Galilee. He's going to go to this region, and he's going to minister, he's going to serve, he's going to heal, he's going to teach, he's going to do all these things. But it tells us that he had to go through to Galilee from Judea. But we find him at the Jordan River. And here's the issue. That between Galilee to the north and Judea to the south is this region called Samaria. And Samaria is filled with a people group called the Samaritans that were, there's a ton of history here. There's 1,000 years of history that led to this intense hatred, a racism, a hatred of people group that we don't really even mirror today. Like our culture is full of the brokenness of racial tension and racial brokenness, and it goes in so many different ways. And I think the gospel challenges us to look at that. But what we have here really doesn't even in any way come close to what went on between the Jews and the Samaritans. And part of it is because their story starts where it's tied together. They have the same ancestors, but about 1,000 years before that the line broke, there was a civil war between the northern half of Israel and the southern half. It led to all kinds of things, and then a couple conquests where both sides then allied with their enemies of their brother, basically. And now the Samaritans, this group of people, had lost both their ethnic identity, their religious identity. They were pretty much obstinately opposed to the Jews. They had set up their own city of worship. They had set up their own way of doing God and religion. And they had set up their own values and their own way of seeing the world that was opposite of the way the Jews saw the world. And in the midst of this, they had really become bitter enemies. So that if a Jewish person saw a Samaritan on the street, they would walk on the other side. And specifically, if you had to go from Judea to Samaria, the fastest way was to take a road that went right through Samaria. But no good Jew did it that way. They would take a trip where they would cross the Jordan River, so they would go to the east several miles, cross the Jordan River, and take a separate road that bypassed Samaria because they just didn't want to have anything to do with these folks. Now, what we find is that Jesus is actually near the Jordan River. And so for him, the trip that most Jews would normally take was a shorter trip. He was already there. All he had to do is cross the water, take that road, go north, and then come back to Galilee where he was headed. And so, it's just obvious. His disciples are probably going, wait, we're going back to Galilee. We should be going this way. And Jesus is like, no, we're going this way. Because here's what the text tells us. Verse 4 says, he must go through Samaria. Now, the word must there is not the idea that, you know, hey, there's a map and this is just the way we're going. We have to go this way. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if I'm going to go downtown, I must hop on I-44. That's where I'm going. That's not what it's saying. Must here is a declaration that there's an obligation, that Jesus knows there is something he has to do. And it's tied to the story. In other words, what John is letting us know is that Jesus knew that his mission was going to take him to this well. And he had to go this way. He had to break social traditions. He had to break the way that like even his own disciples saw the world. He chose to go through Samaria, and intentionally he ended up at this well that's near the city called Sychar, that's near the capital city. It's the house of worship where the Samaritans would have done their religion. And he sits on this well because he is worn out. And it is here where this woman walks up to him in the middle of the day. And we have this rich, beautiful, wonderful encounter between Jesus and the woman at the well. What the text tells us, it's about the sixth hour. We read that and go, sixth hour. What is that? And you know, if the natural reading, is that like 6 a.m.? But they were counting from 6 a.m. So 6 hours is actually high noon. It is high noon in the Middle East. In cultures around the world where water is scarce or hard to get, it is normally the job in those cultures of women to go obtain water. It's just the way the world is. We go to Haiti. And when we go to Haiti, where there are water sources, what you will find is that you will find women who are walking on the street with a big old ginormous jar on their head, and they're walking with an empty jar towards the water source, and they will fill that jar, they will put it back on their head, and they will walk back with it. This is a similar thing to what would go on in this culture. And there is a well, and we find out that the well was built by their ancestor, a guy named Jacob, who had lived about 1,500 years before this event. And Jacob, 1,500 to 1,800 years before this event, Jacob dug this well. It had been in that section up till that day. And believe it or not, you could hop on an airplane, go to the Middle East, and see a well that was dug by Jacob, the ancestor of the Jewish faith. It is still a working well to this day. That well has existed for almost 4,000 years. And it was the place where people would come to gather water. But in what you would do, and what like we see this in Haiti, you don't do this at noon. It's hot. It's miserable. It's dusty. It's terrible. And so what happens is first thing in the morning, later in the evening, women would come to the well, and the well became their version of Breadco, right? Where you didn't just go to the well. You got there and you hung out and you chit-chatted and you talked and everybody kind of did together. We're filling each other's water parts as a group, and it's time to gossip. It's time to talk about the world. It's time to complain about our husbands. It's time to tell everybody how terrible our kids are and how we had to hold them down and give them a noogie, you know, and all that kind of stuff, right? It's the time where women would kind of gather. It was the social location where women would come together and hang out. And what I want you to notice right away is that this woman comes at noon by herself. Something's going on. The story's going to let us know a little bit about this. She shows up at noon and she finds a Jewish man sitting on the well. And the Jewish man just looks at her and goes, "I'm thirsty. Will you give me a drink?" And she responds to him by going, wait a minute. Why would you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink? She recognizes the fact that there are significant barriers between this man sitting at the well and herself. What are those barriers? Well, first of all, there's a deep racial barrier that no good, loving Jewish person would have ever crossed. She says, "Don't you know Jews don't have any dealings?" In other words, don't you know that a Jewish person would never put themselves where they were a recipient of something that a Samaritan would do? You're not acting like your countrymen. I know how you guys are. You don't mess with us unless somebody's making money off of it. Why are you asking me for a drink? There is a racial barrier here. There is a a gender barrier here. Because generally men had conversations with their wives more in private, but even in public, there was this social barrier where men didn't talk to women, and Jesus is actually risking his reputation to have this conversation. A single man sitting and talking to a woman in the middle of the day would raise eyebrows. And so there's a gender area. There is also a religious barrier here. As Jesus, and we're going to see a little bit about this as the story goes on, this religious barrier that says, hey, you have your religion, I have mine, and you stay on your side of the street, I'll stay on mine. I'll believe my God, you believe yours, but let's not try to come together and have conversation. And on top of that, we find out that there's a deep moral barrier. This is a woman who is hurting, broken. She's been in multiple relationships. She's been in and out of marriages 5 times. Now she's living with a guy who's not her husband. She is coming to the well because she's tired of the stigma. She's tired of women. She's tired being the brunt of the gossip that goes on around the well in the middle of the day. She's tired of people looking at her the way they look and treating her the way they treat her. She's tired of being the outsider. And it's a heck of a lot easier to just go there by myself in the middle of the day than to deal with that. Do those people live around us? Are those people here in Eureka? Are there single moms who have been through the hardship of life and they just feel like they're an outsider and it's just easier to keep to myself and stay away from everything else? Are there people who are struggling with issues of failure and brokenness in their life that it's way easier for me to just do life where I keep a distance from anybody and everybody? Are there people in our lives who look at religion and go, no matter what I do, you won't accept me, so I'm just not going to have anything to do with you anyway? And the question we need to ask is, does the Jesus that we worship during Christmas have anything to say to those people? That's kind of what I've been wrestling with this week. What is the offer? Because I see people, their lives are a hot mess. And sometimes if our message is, Jesus loves you, and what that means is he really wants you to have this perfect in-the-box life, somehow that just doesn't resolve with the way we live our lives in this world. And so we'll either hide our lives or we'll clean ourselves up to make ourselves look good, or we'll just check out and go, this doesn't apply to me anyway. And what I want you to like clearly see is that Jesus intentionally goes out of his way to sit on this well and to engage this woman with a compassionate conversation. Like, see it. I mean, picture this well. Picture this moment. Picture the king that, if you're a follower of Jesus, that you say that you serve and worship. And then look into the eyes of this woman. It tells us, the text, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute, tells us that she'd been married 5 times, and now the woman, or the man that she's with now is not her husband. You need to understand that in that culture, women didn't have the power of divorce. Now, she kept pursuing men, but what happened is men just kept using her and casting her off. Can you see into her eyes? Can we resonate with her pain? One of the problems we in our culture of church, like where we live, we have a really hard time entering into the pain of people who are not like us. We have a hard time entering into the pain of like this week, Cubans who fled Havana and now live in Little Havana there in Miami, or Syrian refugees, or, I mean, like the list goes on. And the Jesus we worship went out of his way to find this woman and offer her something that is so rich and so beautiful and so real. The weight of that, like, first of all, we have to drink deeply from it ourselves, but when we are, it's got to change us. Right? So look at what he offers her. He's sitting there in verse 9. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Verse 10, Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was that was saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." And the woman said, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with. The well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, and as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Now, Jesus obviously uses a play on the moment and does kind of the same thing he did with Nicodemus a few chapters ago. He shifts the conversation from a current moment to a spiritual example that comes from the moment. And so he says, "Give me a drink." And she says, "Why would you ask me for a drink?" And his response is not, "Well, I just want to let you know that I'm here and I'm really on a mission from God and I'm here to be your redeemer." He looks at her and goes, "If you knew who I was, we would flip the tables. You would be asking me for a living water, a water that would well up inside you, a water that would leave you where you're never thirsty again." And now she's like, that sounds interesting. I'm tired of every day putting this water pot on my head. I'm tired of coming to this well. I'm tired of kind of watching to wait and waiting to see when everybody leaves before I show up. I just don't want to come back here anymore. That sounds amazing." And so she's looking for water because we know that we need water because we are thirsty. Thirst is a real natural thing. And daily water is part of what has to happen. And so what Jesus does in this conversation as he offers her living water, he offers her living water. He offers her something that will quench the thirst deep from within. Because it is natural for us to be thirsty. It is natural for us to need something deep in our souls. And living water, Jesus gives her an offer for something that will quench her thirst. She is a thirsty person. We are all thirsty people. And he offers her something rich and beautiful. And instead of being something that you needs a bucket that reaches down and pulls it up, he says, "Listen, this will be a fountain. It will be a well that springs up. It will be a spring." For several years, we used to live in central Missouri. And when we lived in central Missouri, we used to love to go down to Ha Ha Tonka State Park. Now, I have no idea why somebody in Missouri would name something Ha Ha Tonka, but we come up with all kinds of crazy names here, right? We named, like, a city that's spelled Nevada, we call it Nevada. And we have all kinds of crazy names. Like, I used to live real close to Versailles, Missouri, that is spelled like Versailles. Like, we're weird in Missouri with our names. And somehow we came up with a Ha Ha Tonka State Park, which is weird. But at Ha Ha Tonka State Park, at the bottom of this kind of valley, is the largest freshwater spring in the state of Missouri. It flows right into Lake of the Ozarks, but this freshwater spring is amazing. It is huge. It comes out of this cave that is the size of this room. Like, the opening is the size of the back of this room, and as it comes out, and it is gushing nonstop water that is clear and it is cold and it is fresh and it is beautiful. And you go down with a cup. It is very healthy to go down with a cup, scoop water right out of it and drink it. And it is so good. It is not like Eureka water. Okay? Now, Eureka water, on the other hand, it leaves you thirsty. It is so refreshing. And here's what Jesus is saying. He's saying, "Listen, you have this little bitty bucket and you're just pulling up once a day Eureka water. I've got this living well. I've got this this thing that will well up and you'll never thirst again. Obviously, it catches their attention, but Jesus is using a metaphor to say you have a different type of thirst, and that thirst shows up in your life in so many different ways, and you start drinking, trying to satisfy that thirst, but the way you go about your life, you have to come back and drink every day, and it leaves you thirsty. And you never really satisfy your thirst. Our thirst shows up. Like, the fact that we are thirsty people shows up in a lot of ways. Here's a couple. Our soul thirst shows up when by having this deep longing for purpose. We long for something to live our lives for that is bigger than ourselves. We just like wake up going, why am I here? What is my life about? I want my life to move towards something. There's got to be a deeper meaning, a deeper desire. We long for purpose. That is just a sign of deep thirst. It shows up in our longing for significance. We want our lives to matter. And we pursue all kinds of things thinking, like, somebody will notice me. My life will make sense. It will be okay because I'm doing something that really matters. We search for significance. We want people to notice us. We want people to think we're okay. We want to leave something here that makes a name for ourselves. It is just a sign of our thirst. We long for love. And we seek after something that will satisfy that longing. These are just indications of thirst. Like, all the Christmas movies are rooted in the fact that we're thirsty, right? This is Clark Griswold. The whole story is Clark Griswold trying to find a place to get a drink. He does it very funny. He longs for purpose, and so the whole story of Christmas Vacation, right, is the fact that Clark Griswold, his purpose in life is he's going to make a great family Christmas. It's going to go just like he says, and everything's going to go wonderful, and he makes a hot mess out of it, right? He just destroys everything. It goes sideways. He longs for significance, and so he lights up the house so everybody in the world can see it. You can see it from the space station because he wants people to think he is amazing. He is searching for love. Like, this longing for love shows up all through the story, and you got to love the scene. If you're not familiar with Christmas Vacation, sorry, use it a Christmas movie illustration, but watch the movie. It's a great one. Like, there's Christmas movies, and then there's Christmas Vacation. But he's up in the attic, right? And he stops and he watches the movie after he has the whole slapstick thing where he keeps hitting himself in the head. But he starts rolling the reel, and what's he doing? He is feeling the longing of love that he had when he was a kid. And there's something in him that longs for that. Listen, it's just a movie about thirst and about where he goes to get a drink to fulfill that thirst. All the Christmas movies have this basic theme. We are thirsty people. Our thirst is real. The problem is not that we're thirsty, and this is where religion struggles. Our problem yells at thirsty people and says, stop being thirsty. We need to realize that thirst is real. The problem is not that we thirst. The problem is where we're drinking to satisfy the thirst. It's the fact that rather than coming to the fountain, the headwaters of eternal life, we are trying to get a drink out of a well that's got dirty, nasty, dingy Eureka water, right? And so here's this woman. It's really crazy what happens in the conversation. In verse 16 and 19, she goes, give me the water. And watch what Jesus goes all sideways on her. And it's always seemed awkward to me. Like, he's like, I'll give you this living water. And she's like, oh, give it to me so I don't have to drink. I don't have to come back here. And he goes, hey, go get your husband and bring him here. And now she's kind of sheepish, kind of like, I don't have a husband. And then Jesus looks her in the eye. Look at it. Verse 17, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you're right in saying I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true. And I love the woman's response. I now see that you are a prophet. Duh. You know, you just peered into my soul and saw everything that is broken. But what's he saying to her? He's saying, listen, for you to ever come to the point where you drink from this well, what I have to do is I have to show you that where you're drinking from now is not working. What's this woman been doing? She's been coming back to the same well over and over and over again, trying to fill the thirst that is in her soul with something that just never, ever satisfies. This is us. This is us running to sex and power and running to money, running to the joy of Christmas as something that will ultimately satisfy. It is us running back every day at noon to Jacob's well, just filling a little bitty cup with dirty water. So how do you change that? And the answer that Jesus is saying here, this is why it's so beautiful, is he's saying, I am offering you a spring that will well up from the inside. The way a spring works, if you have dirty water, right? Recently this was very interesting. I don't know if you saw this, but here in St. Louis we had this creek in North County that they woke up one morning, they went out, and the water was like a weird color of grayish white. And it was all over the news, and everyone's like, where did this come from? What's wrong with this? And 3 or 4 days, it did not go away. They finally found out that this company had dumped a bunch of stuff in the water. But the challenge is, how do we get this clean? And the answer, like, you can't go to that water and just start scooping that water out. It doesn't work. It's way too much. It's all polluted. It's all dirty. It's all a mess. It's all horrible. What's the only way that can be cleaned out? And that is, upstream, there has to be a fresh water source that just keeps pumping water into it that is clean. There needs to be a fountain that flows into the dirty water that just pushes the dirty water out and cleanses it, makes it drinkable, makes it beautiful, makes it whole, makes it wonderful. This is what Jesus is saying. Listen, if you try to address the dirty water and just get a different well, get a different place where you dig a new hole and dig down and find a new place to get water, it's not going to work. What we need in our lives is a different fountainhead. We need a different center. We need something that down deep within us fills us with something that we were designed for, living water. And Christ says, I give that. I give that. He is offering people who are drinking from nasty wells a fountainhead. So often we focus in our religious approach about what people have to give up. And yes, that needs to happen. I mean, this woman needs to hear, listen, stop drinking there. But the only way we're going to get there is if you offer something that will satisfy way deeper and more, right? Living water, that's what Jesus offers her here. Can we feel the beauty of this offer with this woman? Maybe you're a hot mess this morning. Listen, the solution is not in a religious way, just keep going to the same wells. It is finding Christ, who is our living water. And then from there, he offers her a different way of seeing the world with not just living water, but legitimate worship. She shifts on him real quick. She goes, all right, I see you're a prophet, and you're now meddling. You're now in my business, and I don't like that. Like, none of us would. None of us would like to be talking to some guy, and all of a sudden he's pulling up, you know, what happened when we were 18 and talking about that night we were out and acted a fool, and when we ended up, you know, hungover and, you know, drunk or did some really stupid stuff in our lives. Like, nobody wants that moment where somebody goes, yeah, I remember that. And you're like, hey, you weren't there. Let's find something else to talk about. So she kind of shifts the conversation. She does it in a classic way. She goes, hey, I see you're a prophet. Let's have a theological discussion. Let's have a conversation about religion, because that gets the heat off of me. And she goes, all right, so you're a prophet. You're like a Jewish guy. We believe that we worship here. You believe that we worship in Jerusalem. So she points to the place where they go, which is on this mountain that's real near where they're at. And this is our place of worship. You Jews believe that you should worship in Jerusalem and you should have your services there. And the worship that the Samaritans did was no longer based on the Old Testament, how God had prescribed it. It was kind of picking and choosing a whole bunch of religions, mixing it together, coming up with a salad bowl of stuff, and then saying, this is what we believe, this is what we worship. The Jews still held worship in the one true living God who had made a covenant with these people. But she's saying, okay, where do we go to worship? What's the right place? And she's kind of saying, I get worship is like a thing that we do. It's a place that we go. Where's the right place? And it's her, like, I really believe this is this woman's way of getting the heat off of herself. But in this, we see Jesus offering her not only living water, but this beautifulness of legitimate worship. He's saying that when that living water starts to spring up inside of you, when you see Christ for who he truly is, when you see the beauty, something will happen in the way you see the world that'll shift worship for you. She sees worship as a place and an event. And he has this beautiful conversation where 11 times in about 6 verses the word worship is used, that he tries to shift this. This is one of these places where someday we're going to come back to this verse and just talk about the implications of what Jesus says about our worship, both when we come together on Sunday morning and when we leave. But this morning, I just want to get at the overarching thing, because here's this woman sitting here, and she has gone to a theological discussion, and Jesus gets her right to where all of us need to be, which is that worship is not an event. It is not a place. It is a posture of our heart. And it is a posture of our heart that is a response. What we so often try to do is we try to conjure up worship. And so we're told that if we, you know, can get in here and, you know, man, the cooler we get and the more hip we are and the more we are, you know, if we can bring some smoke machines in there and get a laser show going, right, it would make us feel all excited. We're conjuring up emotions, trying to draw you into an experience. And I think Jesus is saying that's not what's happening in worship. Worship is an attitude of our heart that responds to what has already been done for me. And so he looks at her and he says, there's a time coming, verse 21, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. Now, first look, it sounds like his argument is, hey, doesn't matter where you worship, doesn't matter how you worship, just as long as you worship with this inner feeling of you know, spirit and truth, it's kind of the idea. But that's not really what Jesus is communicating to the woman. He's saying, listen, there's an hour coming and is now here. This is where you got to read the whole Gospel of John, because we've already talked about this if you've been in here. That hour that is coming is the hour of the cross of Christ. He is referencing now the fact that the temple in Jerusalem, 2 chapters ago, the reference already showed up that the temple is going to be replaced as the ultimate sacrifice is given by Christ. He is going to become the true and better temple, who is the place where God meets man through a sacrifice of Jesus' life. And he's saying, listen, the time's coming where this place is not going to be as important as what those picture, what those symbolize. But then he says something interesting to her. He says, listen, understand this, you worship in ignorance. In other words, you are worshiping what you don't understand, and therefore it's not complete, it's not accurate. On the other hand, the Jews worship from revelation, for salvation comes from the Jews. So we can't get from this, it doesn't matter how or where you worship, just as long as you feel something. No, Jesus says, listen, there is a right God and there is a right way for us to worship God, and true worship is going to align with that. But then he says this incredible passage, those who worship will worship in spirit and in truth. And then there's this crazy phrase where he says, God is seeking worshipers like that. He looks at this woman sitting on this well, this broken, hurting woman, and he's saying, listen, God is seeking. He's looking for people who will see him and fall on their face and worship before him. The word worship here is literally a Greek word that means to fall before and to kiss up. It is the response of someone to somebody who is great, But most often it flows not out of a sense of duty, but when somebody in adoration and love is now paying homage to somebody who is before them. It is a slave who's been set free by a king who has conquered the slaveholders and has set them free. It is a person who has experienced the beauty of a moment in their life by somebody who has poured grace. And it is the response that we have of awe when we're in moments where we see the greatness of a situation. It is when I climb to the top of a mountain. I remember doing this in Vail, Colorado, getting to the very top of one mountain and then looking out across the way and seeing like all these mountain peaks. There wasn't anything in me that wanted to stand on top of that mountain going, look at me, I'm awesome, right? I just stood there trembling going, whoa, like what a moment. And like my heart just naturally responded to what I was experiencing. It was beautiful. It was rich. C.S. Lewis helps us here. What is going on? C.S. Lewis talks about this in a couple of his books, but he talks about the fact that he used to have a struggle. And in his letters on the Psalms, he talks about the fact that when he saw God saying, I seek worshipers, worship me, praise me, he used to go, that seems like if we've met anybody who kind of thumped their chest and goes, hey, you need to think I'm great, you need to think I'm awesome, we would go, that's weird. Like, that makes me uncomfortable. I don't like people who are seem to be self-absorbed. And so a God who keeps saying, worship me, praise me, I'm speaking worshipers who worship me like this, seems a little weird. But he said, until I came to the realization that we praise and worship naturally things that we found awe in or we love. He says a lover doesn't have any trouble over and over again looking in the eyes of his beloved saying, I love you, you are awesome, and I want the whole world to know it, right? Look at, how could you look at anybody else? She's beautiful. She's my girl. A mountain climber doesn't have any trouble finding joy at the top of the mountain. Go, look at this place. We naturally respond in worship and awe to things that are just there before us that we love and we find beauty and greatness in. And so what's going on here? C.S. Lewis says, it is by worship that God communicates himself to us. Jesus says, these are the type of worshipers that God is seeking. Because what God wants to do is he wants to give us himself. And when we see, like when the fountain is flowing, all of a sudden, all the things that we worship in this world, because we are worshipers, we are bowing down to something. When we see the beauty of Christ in his fullness, those other things fade away and we hold on to the one who really matters, and all of a sudden, like, there is a readjustment of what really matters in our heart because we see it in its fullness. That's what we all need. That's what every person on this planet needs is not to have religion beaten in their heads. They need to see Christ. And if God will open their eyes to seeing the beauty of Jesus, their heart will do nothing but respond in worship. They will go, what a great God, what a great Savior, what a great Redeemer we have. He is awesome. And you start seeing Jesus in all his fullness, like that will set off in our hearts. You ever see that kid who's got their little stuffed animal on Christmas morning? And the stuffed animal's like falling apart. There's an ear torn. There's cotton falling out of it. And here, you know, they got their little whoopee, you know, or whatever they call it, you know, the little thing. And they're walking around with it. And it's Christmas morning. You're trying to give presents, but you can't get that daggum stuffed animal out of their hands because they think it's the most important, most valuable, most amazing thing in the world. And they just won't let it go. What's that little three-year-old doing? It's worshiping. It is attached value to something that he is holding on to, and he won't let go of it because he thinks it's all that really matters. Y'all, that's who we are. We're the little three-year-old who are holding on to stuff, and we are bowing down, giving ourselves to it. And in the midst of it, God is looking at us going, there's so much more. But the only way your eyes are open to it is if you look deeply into Christ and then trust him. Give yourselves to him wholly, fully. You will find that he is living water. He is the one who is worthy of our worship. You will have a heart shift so that worship is not an event. It is a posture of my heart. So when we come together, like on Sunday morning, we're not trying to conjure up your emotions. Our emotions are so deeply tied to it, but we're not trying to come here on Sunday morning, sing a few songs, have me tell you a few stories and get you like all emotionally riled. Our emotions are tied to it, but what we want to do is we want to offer you living water. We want you to see Jesus and know the one who is worthy of our worship and give yourself to him so that your heart will naturally erupt to love. This is why we sing. This is why our music is so important. Because it gives you a chance to vocalize that. It gives you a chance here for a moment to stop and go, man, my heart is moved. We sing about the stuff we enjoy, okay? If you went through your top 50 playlist on iTunes, you will see a lot of things about what your heart tends to pull to in worship, right? Well, if we can't stop here and have our hearts lifted in song, man, there's something amiss. We come together so that we can look together at the beauty of Christ and respond to him in worship. That's what we do. We respond to him with giving. We respond to him with thanksgiving. The goal is to lift Christ up and make much of him. And then to realize that the offer of Christ is something that goes with us. So if you're here today and you're seeking, you're searching, you're trying to figure this thing out, this morning I want to offer you living water. I want to tell you that there is one who will reach you wherever you are. And I know that our lives are a hot mess. I know that some of you come in here and you've put on a facade, you're playing the part, you're acting because you don't want anybody to know what's really going on deep in your soul. And I know that sometimes it's hard. I just want to tell you there is a fountain. There's a fountain welling up to eternal life. I want to tell you that we get our eyes so fixed on ourselves, but if you will just turn from those things, look at the places where you're stopping to drink and run to the well, the fountain. Give yourself to him. You will find a Christ who fills you and leaves you where you don't thirst anymore. And for those of us who are followers of Jesus, it means that Christ is so changing us that these encounters become part of what we are seeking out, right? That we begin to cross those barriers and move towards people like Christ did. This is Hope Week, right? This is the hope we're offering. The hope of living water. Now with that, during Christmas, we do a couple things that live all this out. The first thing is the gift of love store, and we're going to have more announcement about this later, but this is kind of the last week for us to really emphasize that and make sure everybody goes out and is generous with their giving towards that. And so I just want to challenge you to look in your worship folder and do that. The other thing is that all through the month of Christmas, all through after Thanksgiving, so starting today, all through till the end of December, we as a church are actively taking up what is called the Advent Conspiracy Offering. It is an offering that we intentionally take up at Christmas because this is a time where we're thinking giving. And I know Christmas is a crazy season where our tendency is that we overspend and we max out our credit cards and all that kind of stuff. The challenge of Advent Conspiracy is to say to us, maybe we need to rethink that, downsize some of our giving and some of the gift giving, and maybe part of what we need to do is think about what it looks like to invest some of our Christmas and things that matter way beyond the toy that will last for a few months. And so what we just encourage you to do is to start praying about this and consider how you will give. The collection we take during Advent Conspiracy, there's not a dime that will stay here. It goes to our international partnerships. So one of those partnerships that you'll hear a little about here in just a minute is with Living Waters International. It's appropriate for today because guess what they do? They go to places and they build wells so that people can have living water in their community. The ladies, I've seen it in Haiti, the ladies who used to walk 10 miles with a thing on their head now can go down the street to where there's a pump where they can get the water right in their own little neighborhood. And so they go and build wells where people don't have clean drinking water. We also support international missions with this. We are connected with an orphanage in Haiti. We are part of a church planting organization in Ecuador. And all the money for our Advent Conspiracy offering goes specifically to things that are overseas, that are outside of our borders, outside of us. This is not an offering for stuff that goes on here. It is a way to generously give to the cause of Christ around the world. We just want to encourage you to pray about that. And so while you're thinking about that, we're going to show you a video up here that will tell you a little bit about that. And then our band will come up and we're going to sing a few songs and lifting our heart in worship to Christ. All right.